I'm going to talk about our situation. And get right down to it, because we have a short time. We'll need a characterization of some kind of the West before speaking of origins and ironies and prospects. And some of you will recall from courses in times past one style, this style, of characterizing what it means to live in the West. I'll begin by imagining that mental life can proceed in two quite different ways. In one, a way with which we're all entirely familiar, we act upon a world of distinct, differentiated things by continuing to differentiate them. The drawing, which is a schematizing of a school of logic of the second half of the 20th century, shows on the left-hand side, shows, for those of you who aren't here, it's on the left-hand side of a picture on the blackboard, a clear field that is cut. Once it is cut, there is a distinction between the left and the right side of it. It could be cut horizontally, and there would be a distinction between the upper part and the lower part. One can continue to cut, and one can continue to name the sectors that are then marked off. If I had done both cuts, then we would have, so to speak, a northeast sector, a southeast sector, a northwest and southwest sector. We can continue to do that sort of thing. And we are familiar with this straight away from various taxonomies. But since this is the distinction between the two sides of this picture is so important to what it is that I want to say, especially with regard to our prospects, that I want to remain with it. We make distinctions all the time. We believe without articulating the belief that we can't get on without them. We are told, for example, in schools that there is a one best word for a particular description. If we use the wrong word, we're punished. We're humiliated, we're graded down, we're looked at with the look, which we all remember from our third grade teachers. We are compelled to make ever finer distinctions, and especially since we know from operant conditioning that we do better when we're complimented, that a reward system for virtuosity in distinction making is, if anything, in place in all modern school systems. So that children who are very good at language, which is to which I will come in a moment, but let me say a clearer, simpler example, in mathematics, as they get better at it, they are, to a degree, separated out from those who are not so quick and not so intuitive about mathematics, until a kind of pyramid of competency with regard to mathematics is created. And to that, in fact, I will come at the very end of my remark. But that doesn't apply to most of us, really. Our distinctions are often the distinctions of the shopping center. We make distinctions between bargains and non-bargains, and between this object at this price, that object at another price. Distinctions lie at the heart. There are chairs up here. Come sit in front. At the heart of buying and selling. And that, by the way, is no coincidence. The linkage between the proliferation and enforcement of distinction making as a habit of mind and buying and selling is a very close, and in fact, at different moments in the life of a number of cultures, decisive. The term univocity, which some of you in past courses that we had together will probably remember, comes from W.D. Ross, the great translator of Aristotle. Aristotle is the codifier of much of what I'll be speaking about on this side of the blackboard. Univocity will refer to a constellation of mental and activities and verbal performances and social behaviors characterized by precision, by single meanings, by getting down to the right word, to the right and most precise job description ad nauseum. In the realm of univocity, in the realm in which distinction making is equated with intelligence itself, and for a kid, with worthwhileness itself, which is a terrible thing, a terrible, disgraceful thing, a perfect example of the bad faith of the adult world to its own children. In that realm, we find everywhere the construction of hierarchies. I just drew this because you make lines separating regions from other regions. You make lines, so to speak, horizontally in a three-dimensional space, and you get tiers of a hierarchy. This way. You make crosshatches on each tier to create, say, job descriptions. The refinement of distinction making in hierarchies was shown actually, was it 10 or a dozen years ago when a Nobel Prize was given, principally for the refinement of methods to clean up corporate hierarchies, to make them more efficient, which is to say, to make certain that there are no crossings of these lines, no spillage from one region to another. I'll return to social hierarchies in a moment, but this hierarchy, this one beneath, is of particular interest because it involves language. In that realm, we speak or attempt to speak and are rewarded for speaking with precise words, univocal words, and when we use words in groups, we extend the notion of precision to the orderliness among words, so that syntactic order is held as a loose but important grid into which we plug our words. It's of great interest that in many Indo-European languages, we see subjects, predicates, indirect objects all the time. And when we don't see them, they're felt as variations of that sequence. Now, syntactic order, so to speak, connected with sentences or small word groups, can be relatively loose, but something must be said for a particularly consequential grouping of small word groups into arguments, because then sequentiality is not negotiable. At this level of the hierarchy, and you see it looks like one, a hierarchy, with the word regnant at the top, if this word is not perfectly precise, it cannot be carried down into the sentence properly. If the sentence is not syntactically correctly constructed, it cannot be carried down into the fundamental structure of the of argument in the West, the syllogism. And we didn't concern ourselves technically with the syllogism, except to say that we have another tripartite structure. One kind of sentence, another kind of sentence called universal and particular, and a certain kind of particular sentence called a conclusion, which, if they're correctly made, lock up into an irrefragable argument, an argument that cannot be gainsaid. This is triumph, a triumph of its kind. Its elegance, its power. There is Simone Weil wrote a book about Homer and about different, partly about different senses of the idea of power. Well, this is a powerful macrostructure by several definitions of the word. Structures of some span, say groups of arguments, can be characterized as hypotactic. I just want a word. The word comes from grammarians, mainly 19th century grammarians, who admired sentences like and sections and chapters in books like Gibbon's The Decline and Fall, where the words are marvelously chosen. The sentences are beautiful. The sentences are compound, complex, periodic sentences. They're magnificent structures themselves, but not so magnificent as the argument of the chapter. And the chapters fit into multiple volumes that make an exhausting argument, of which, in fact, Gibbon himself looked back upon with some irony at the end of his life. Hypotactic structures, because I want to contrast them in a moment with another kind of structure. The Golden Gate Bridge is a hypotactic structure. And we'll, to anticipate, the Pyramid of Cheops is a paratactic structure, as you'll see in a moment. Now, this seems to have to do with mental operations, and this with language. Contest. Why? Because arguments are frequently the first, the weaponry of first recourse in small, middle, and large scale engagements of persons living in that world, running from, I don't want to eat Chinese tonight. We ate Chinese last night. Well, what do you want to do? You want to eat Italian? I mean, remember the last time you got a stomachache? It wasn't so pleasant. After a few exchanges, one of you will win, right? And you'll go to one or the other place. As anybody with a dram of sense knows, you multiply arguments like that, and things aren't going to last indefinitely. Two, corporations, nation states, blocks of nation states, engagements that are construed as contests, zero-sum contests, in which there will be a winner and a loser. And again, in the first instance, very often, it is, again, back to virtuosity and argumentation, which the West has decided to give over to law school. You want to become a virtuoso argumenter? I remember when the law boards were altered, and I was kind of very indirectly consulted on that. And, oh my goodness, I didn't know what to do. They were cleaned up, just the way this guy Simon cleaned up General Motors, you know, to make sure there was no spillage across these distinct lines of distinction. The exam had to be tougher on the syllogism. You had to make sure that the kids who were being admitted to law school had this kind of potentiality for spotting a syllogism a mile away, for constructing the third part when all they had was the first and half of the second. Can you test that? That's easy. That's the kind of stuff you can test. So they, quote, improved, unquote, the law boards, and people would come to me and ask me, how should I study for the law boards? And I sent them to one of the better introductory logic texts written by a person I knew, Irving Copy. Contest. We have almost no intuitions for the dissolution of distinctions, almost no experience as adults with observing a field that is differentiated, that is, the differentiation given to the senses. We see pine trees and oaks. We see them. They are distinct. Why should we erase the distinction between them and just say trees? Well, perhaps it won't appear that the stakes are very high in the case of trees, although an argument can be made that the stakes are. But we'll get to stakes of ultimate height shortly. In this realm, a field with a differentiation in it, a cut in it, can be rendered clear. The cut, by the way, and again, it's not my language, cut. I can't help it if I say healed on this side. The cut healed yields a space without differentiations. And if we were just for a moment to look at what a formal hierarchy, especially a pyramidal one in three dimensions, would look like, we would end up with one flat plane We would eliminate all of these. We'd squish them down. Then we'd look at what was left, and there'd be all these superimposed cross-hatchings, so we'd erase all those. And then finally, we would have an undemarcated single plane. That is really interesting. That is where the dancer is the dance. What's a word in the polysemous realm? Many meanings. Polysemy. Well, it's a word with many meanings. Would we expect a person in that realm to be a person with many meanings? Oh, that sounds rather interesting. Over on the right-hand side, right white-hand side, being a job with a particular description, that doesn't upset me very much. It's true that I like to read and run and play the oboe and play with my kids. But at work, all I do is differential equations. That's all I do. And in fact, given the economy, you know, higher productivity, I have to work a 60-hour week. That's the way it is. So I don't really have time to do any of those things. So I'm a contracted person. I'm like a word with merely one meaning. On this side, it looks as if that person, hypothetical me, has all this stuff, does all these things in a day, does them all. A person of many meanings, of many definitions. If a word has many meanings, how in the world are you going to build an elegant syntactic structure and a powerful logistic structure? How? You can't. Because the word will shift its meanings on you as it drops down. We are dropping this word down. Remember this word? This word is the same as this one, is the same as this one. Constancy in meaning vertically is as important as precision of meaning horizontally. Here, we have protean meanings. I might acquire another meaning here in a half an hour. That being the case, I can no longer rely upon my sentence holding together, and I simply cannot build arguments. Now, the first thing anybody might say, someone might say, is you can't build a culture that way. You can't make a life. Wrong. It's true that one of the projects of cultures that live over here is to eradicate cultures that live over here. That doesn't mean that people cannot live successfully that way. As a matter of fact, with a certain important modification. Well, a nice one. I mean, a happy one. Modification. We will see that persons did extremely well over a very long period of time, assuming that this is the whole of the human endowment. Whoops. And not just this. Parataxis refers to big groups with no particular structure of full entities. The pyramids, but better, a group of kids full of life, playing. They're not playing games with whole hierarchical sets of rules. They're playing. They're playing in a paratactic space as full entities. Under those conditions, what might be a characteristic relationship among humans? Well, this is an empirical claim rather than a hypothetical one. Persons seemed to have had a lively capacity so to weaken the distinctions between themselves or among themselves, in a larger group, that they could come to feel that they were each other. Oh, perhaps sometime in your fifth or sixth decade you might have a mask made for you in which the faces of all the members of your clan are painted or incised. And you wear the mask and you are they. You are all of them. You are there. Fusion does not come from the combining of light elements to make a lot of noise. It's a term that's often used in microbiology in connection with the outer surface of plasma membranes. When cells, we're all of us made of billions of cells, healthy cells, When cells are healthy, they have regions of fusion on them. Whoop. And if they didn't, we would be very dissipated indeed. A little fuss was made. This was a symbol, this here, I brought this. Not necessary that you bring them. This was the symbol of the class we did. It had to do with suggesting that received wholes, that is WHOLES, received wholes, what we are told are wholes, are actually halves. And that it's a very important matter to see something that we are told is a whole thing and know that it's half a thing. So this is a flutophone. It's not two. This is a flutophone. This is half a flutophone. This comes from Caitlin, by the way, my daughter, who reminded me when she was five that a commercial cookie in the student union are having been used to the proper size cookies that had been baked and still are baked at Hobart and William Smith was half a cookie. And I thought it was a whole cookie. Having been enlightened, my entire intellectual life was moved into another path. That's how it goes. This is an ancient symbol for the female principle, as you undoubtedly know. It was also method and anti-method. Play a melody on this and noodle around on this, and you get a fugue of method and anti-method. And polychromely hued people over on this side and blandly hued people on this side, and male and female. And the two phonation chambers of marine mammals who play fugues all the time. Earlier in the summer, then I'll get back to my work. Early in the summer, I was talking to a group about kindness. And the part of the point of that was that we might be halves. Not as Plato says in the Symposium, that's different. In the Symposium, Aristophanes or somebody says that we're only half, we're looking for the half. That's a very romantic idea. It's all harmless, I suppose. I mean something deeper than that. That what if person is very remarkably boundary dissolved with another person if those two people are a person. A person. And then when they leave, their halves called wholes, and they stay confused on that subject much of their life. Well, we would certainly never permit the severance of the two halves of a flutophone into single, whatever you would call them. Ever. By the way, the flutophone company was quite upset when I retired. Nobody else was upset, but they were upset. I called them, they bawled me out. I don't know, they may have gone out of business. I don't know. I think we ordered something like 20,000 of them. That's a lot of flutophones. It's a lot of half flutophones. I'd like to rotate this scheme to a very gross kind of temporal picture in order to move this argument in a certain direction. Around 40,000 years ago, 45,000 years ago, there had been Homo sapiens sapiens for a long time before that, as we know, at least a quarter of a million years, maybe longer. But around that time, we were the only kind of Homo sapiens there were, so we were by ourselves. Maybe we were halved then, I don't know. But people precisely like us, genetically identical to us, lived in pleasant parts of the earth from then. In different ways, in bands that we've all heard about and in villages. Until around 6,000 years ago, something happened. I think there's a Joseph Heller novel called Something Happened. Not a very good novel. Filled with himself. You have to be filled with yourself nowadays to be a novelist. The very interesting critic said that Keats was a very fine poet while he was filled with himself, and became a great poet when he forgot himself. Something happened so profound that we might as well have had a species change 6,000 years ago. So that's the first of our what follows a colon in the title of the of this talk, Origin. Here, this happened. So, Iraq is in the news for more reasons than Fox News would have us believe. These modes of behavior and thought and feeling and everything nameable and unnameable that human beings have done and are capable of doing, I think, were all mixed together during this period of time. People lived. This would be a truism, except for what I'm going to say next. They lived. They lived in different ways. They seemed to like groups of about 30, 35 people. The paleo demographics has done a lot of work in the last 30 years, and we once thought that we had little herds, you know, with a kind of a headman on top, and then people thought we just did nuclear families, and people thought we lived in a village of 300. And currently, I would say that we think, or they think, that we like to be in groups of around 30, 35 people who have known us since we were born, and as people are born into it, we'd know them until we died, a clan. And when clans got together, if they settled down because some people decided that if you wait around while you plant part of a plant, the rest of it will come up and you'll eat well and you have a bigger family. If you do that, which happened around 10, 12, 15,000 years ago, then these groups of 30, 35 would get together into those villages of 300 or 400. But if they got too big, they'd schism. They would break into, like mitosis, you know, in school, into daughter villages. They didn't just get bigger and bigger. What had been mixed in Sumer between 5,000 and 6,000 years ago was, in my researches, for the first time sorted out into pure cultures of univocity and felicity. I use cultures here in a kind of pharmacological sense. As far as I can tell, for the first time around that time and around here, what had been mixed and, so to speak, proximate, because I want to make a metaphor of distance in a moment, mixed and proximate became sorted out and distanced in such a way that it might not be possible to see down here from here. Well, most of the time you could. If you were up here, you might remember what it was down here. You might have kids. You see your two-year-old behaving a certain way, and if the doors are closed and your spouse isn't in the room, you would behave that way too. You could remember what it was. The question then must be asked, can the distance between pure cultures of univocity and polysemy ever become so great that the one becomes invisible to the other? And this part of the human condition is universally believed to be the whole of it. And the answer is sure. It's happened. It's happened in the last century. And we'll need to know what the we know what the consequences are, but I want to talk about them. By the way, this is about, you know, as Hegel would say, world historical things, but this is also you and me gone to school. Ooh, look, Mom walked me to school, and I walked into the room, And all of a sudden, certain things I do are going to be acceptable, and other things are not going to be acceptable, and I'm going to be punished, and if I have any sense at all, I'm going to stop doing them. What, am I crazy? Am I going to continue to do things that make people stare at me and hurt me and humiliate me? Of course not. So I will begin the work of auto-acceptance of this. Now we regard this. Leave that for a minute later. Is ascent and descent are simultaneous, and they're very steep in Sumer. That's what the books call inventiveness. Oh, all these things are invented. How remarkable that is. Why? Because we have the wheel, your children can go live thousands of miles away and they'll never see you. And you know why, as the old joke goes, which I won't repeat because there are children in the room, you know why? They do it because they can. I don't, well, it's just as well you don't know the feeding line to that terrible joke. This curve is very steep. It flattens out in various places that in some small, trivial degree remind themselves of activities down there. But then there is a tremendous resurgence here in Greece. The most univocal culture ever, before or since. Well, the codifier lived there. But nobody ever did it as well. You read the prior posterior analytics and ask yourself if you've ever read anything as difficult as that in your life. And if you say yes, tell me. The Greeks were the most univocal persons who ever lived. They were geniuses of univocity, and as I'll start aiming us in the direction of in a moment, geniuses of violence. Oh, God, what if it's the case that as the ante goes up with regard to the perfection of univocity, the ante goes up with regard to the inflicting of violence? What if that's true? Historically, is it true? Yes. Can it be explained? That's what we're trying to do, in part. So the Greeks, you know, invent the phalanx. The phalanx is undefeatable. You get 1,000, 2,000 guys who've been eating together and et cetera, since they were kids. And they're very strong. You know, if they drop their swords, they're whipped. They put 6-foot-tall shields in front of them, shields over their heads. They stick 6-foot-long spears in front of them, and they run forward and don't even step on each other's heels. Who, without a tank, can stand against a phalanx? And they also, you know, they also invent tragic drama. I guess that's no surprise. But they invent philosophy and science, too, which, as you'll see, is no surprise. Then there's a flattening out, you know, in Rome. We know about that. And then some things happen, which Gibbon wrote about. And the great structures of Rome, the great univocal empire. We're not talking about, you know, benevolent empires. We can say that now. If we're permitted by Washington to talk about benevolent empire. The great empire, well, Gibbon thought that Rome was a benevolent empire for 150 years. The adoptive emperors, right, were created a commonwealth of polises. The univocity of the empire broke. When we get here, people like Petrarch say that these are dark ages. Oh, look at this. It's terrible. It's decline. Dark ages. So we want to look over to Rome. And the Renaissance people begin to publish Latin texts. And the univocity is spread by the printing press, etc., until we get to a very interesting moment. We might call it, perhaps, Newton's moment around 1687, when a concatenation of one kind of scientific tradition and a special kind of mathematical tradition creates a new kind of univocity, which I'll call in a little while hyper-univocity. those people who are gifted in differential equations and tensor calculus. Now, all this while, this is going on. I don't want to characterize it because I have a terrible kind of conceit, a point to make in a minute about a massive irony. There are countless sub-ironies, but there is a grand unified irony, like GUT's grand unified theory. There is a grand unified irony in this history, which I'll show you in a minute. Now, here we might say that these performances are being disconfirmed so successfully that most of us don't know what they refer to. Words that mean a lot of things. I mean, I picked up Finnegan's Wake one time and I put it right back down. What in the world was he up to? By the way, parenthetically, he was up to the great project of rebalancing the disequilibrium of the West. A very remarkable, a unique project, unlike any other. He tried to restore polysemy. One person. But look at this. So things are getting worse in Greece, worse. They're a little bit better in Rome. You read the City of God as an atheist, not as a Christian. You can make believe you're an atheist. Then what you get is a lot of great stories about Roman gods. Unfortunately, Augustine hates their guts and wishes they'd gone away long before, but he still includes the stories. I mean, he has a rhetorical use for them. But what a source of stories, and that's kind of what's going on. There is a bit of restoration of these things. He lives around 400 AD. But this distance has to be of interest to us. In this case, the first case, distance increases, right? Qualitatively, enormous orders of magnitude increase of distance. In this case, again. To leap forward, it's going to increase again. But here, the distance decreases in medieval Europe. Now, Petrarch says medieval Europe is a bad place, you don't want to go there. And very many very important French medievalists devote their lives to the chronicling medieval history. Actually, at the end of the book, they don't like it. They should have really done something else. You know, French are great cooks. They could have gone to school. It's in medieval Europe that it is possible, you don't find anything like this distance, but possible to discern mixtures of univocity and polysemy. It is possible to discern mixtures of univocity and polysemy, and the great one, there are two great ones for me, Chartres Cathedral, which is both the most extraordinary hypotactic structure and the most really extraordinary paratactic one, deserving of a great deal more time than simply making the claim. And the music that was made for these new spaces, the polytextual motets of largely anonymous music masters, but later named, who were able to do with tones what only really James Joyce 800 years later, tried to do with words. But we pulled out of that. And then here we move into the an age of close to unalloyed, univocal life. Origin. Irony. Here's a scale right here. As we go up with how we value things. Now, for most of Western history, thoughtful people, I would say, or people in general, if they thought about this particular matter quickly between other activities, would regard this world, which one might call the kinship world, the world of clans, the world of clan life in the condition of mixture and proximity of univocity and plismy. So if anybody ever asks you how you would characterize the way human beings lived for 35 or 40,000 years before 5,000 years ago, there's a simple phrase. They lived in kinship clans as persons involved in the mixture and proximity of univocity and plismy. Hardly a definition that we would encounter in a high school or college textbook. Most people would say that these were barbarians. Oh my God, they're dirty. I saw a picture once. They're dirty. And they don't have tall buildings, and they don't wear ties, and they don't write novels and write symphonies, so I guess they're just sort of not human, really. And then civilization comes along, and we get the wheel, and on the plow, and things are wonderful, and then they get a little problematical with a certain Mesopotamian kind of erotic activity that lies somewhere in the footnotes of Gibbon. And then things get really bad. They get almost dirty here. Just look at Swedish movies of think how dirty people are in the medieval world. They get dirty again. And then they clean themselves up, and enlightenment, they're dark here. Enlightenment, they get light. They get lit up. And we get these people whom we admire very much. And then we get science, which is really great because it's giving us cell phones with which we can now be voyeurs without getting caught. Creative voyeurism is a wonderful development. Where's my yellow chalk? This is the grand unified irony. The most narcissistic culture in the history of the world neglected to look in the mirror. Had it, every judgment of itself would have been different. Or if we put the mirror here, two more matters connected with prospects. But I want to link prospects, as if it were a medical question, to remedy. It's no use, in fact it's frivolous, to attempt a diagnosis of an illness, which I would characterize this to be the psychosociopathology of the West. Right here, in Germany between 1933 and 1945, the human condition came to an end. It was impossible to become another person. So one could do to another person what one wished, with no consequence whatsoever to the self. I say that in order to reiterate that it is immoral, a stronger word than frivolous, I guess, to attempt, especially over a long time period, 30 years, a diagnosis of a pathology that did not lead to remedies. Especially if it were possible to construct a diagnosis with regard to which the remedies are clear and simple on the face of it. And I believe that remedy, just prior to looking at prospects, remedy is clear on the face of it. It's not that important, I suppose. Well, I think it's important because we're schoolish people. We think school matters. And alas, it does. It should matter entirely differently from the way it does. But with regard to schools, it would be very important to have the whole of history, in my view, rather than half of it. But the big thing is to restore the other half here, to get what was taken away here back. And that isn't hard to do. One might say, what kind of remedy is that? If this is indeed this problematical, and say someone, a hypothetical person, I'll go along with you, this person says, I don't believe a word you're saying, but I do think we're on the brink of big troubles, because it's very hard to know what's going on in the world without thinking that we're on the brink, we have been for quite a long time, of very big troubles, and we might go over. So why are you talking about the restoration of polysemy to a human condition that has assumed that half of itself was the whole of it? Why not talk about politics and economics and social structures? And the reason I don't now, partly because we haven't time, but the real reason is that whole people can be trusted to work that stuff out by themselves. And they shouldn't be told by people standing in front of other people how they should arrange their lives. They shouldn't be told those things. That's one of our problems, being told, susceptible people being told who they are and how to live. Whole people don't have to be told things. So if they would become whole again, not acquire something they didn't have, but retain what they once had, and that is systematically taken from us. Now, with regard to prospects, I said that just in case we ran out of time, I couldn't have got to it, which would have been a terrible moment for me. Prospects. There is a fine structure to these two terminal points. I don't want to use terminal to, you know, metaphorically. The determini of this picture, there are two of them, univocity and polysemy, the fine structure splits them into halves. Hyperunivocity is farther away from polysemy than univocity is. This is the univocity of the shopping center. We're all good at that. I read one time a piece of PR from a university talking about what it can accomplish for your high school graduate, and virtually the first thing it said was that this university could practically guarantee intelligent consumer choices. The implication being that the university is an intelligent, this particular university is an intelligent consumer choice, and it just gets better from there on. This is a university of everyday life. This is a university of what you might call the technocracy, which is making all these making these things, you know, they're making little teeny molecular machines and submolecular machines. And you say to yourself, well, so what about them? Well, if they're very far from here, as I'm afraid I personally must judge them to be, they're not thinking well about the consequences of their acts. And the consequences of their particular acts can be overwhelming. And here there's something even stranger. Here's polysemy, which we looked at, and this phony polysemy, which is in white chalk, since it's a servant of univocity. Now here's an exam. If phony polysemy, which is in white chalk, is a servant of univocity in white chalk, and this is about buying and selling, what business, do you suppose, has institutionalized phony polysemy? Yes, advertising. The advertising business may be the most important single business in the modern world. The advertising business, I know it sounds a little odd, more important even than General Motors. There wouldn't be a General Motors without J. Walter Thompson? Well, there wouldn't have been a Nixon brain trust without J. Walter Thompson, literally. There would have been no J. Walter Thompson without, was he chairman of the Harvard Psychology Department, who Walter Thompson bought off and made a vice president in order, with perfect efficiency, to manipulate the American and then the world public? Watson, right? John Watson. Harvard University, inventor of behaviorism, vice president of J. Walter Thompson. And there are very subtle things. If you have kids, they're going to want here. They're going to want to be here. They know how to do it. They're going to want to be polysemous. A very clever culture, like us, will put things in between our everyday univocity and real polysemy to literally scare kids away from polysemy. That is the heart of fairy tales. The very heart. It's not, I have to differ with the director of the orthogenic school at the University of Chicago. I went to the University of Chicago and he was famous, infamous person there about fairy tales. The great fairy tale tradition, which again deserves its own discussion, hooks kids into polysemy and then renders polysemy horrifying so that kids will eventually choose univocity. Remarkable achievement. Now, I put these four down because they help us think for 3 or 4 minutes about prospects of the West. I mean, of course, prospects in these terms, so that's... But these are the terms that we have before us. The prospects of the West. First, things can go on as they are. If they go on as they are, the distance will increase some more. So we have to decide whether we want that. Simple as that. We have to decide, as individual persons, whether we want the distance to increase more. It's increasing. It will be greater tomorrow than it is today. It's increasing fairly fast. So there's that. That's certainly a prospect. I'd like to take some others that are, come up in certain other literatures. There are some really, I mean, sweet-seeming people who think that we can do this. We can have hyper-high-tech world, or even take ourselves to other planets, and also have infuse it with some kind of, oh God, spirituality. We'll become spiritual masters of the tensor calculus. I mean, in the 70s, you know, you meet people like that in California every day. It's an interesting view. It is, in theory, impossible and has no precedent in history, so I don't know how much more I can say about it. But it's interesting. That's the second thing. There's a utopian one, which I'm always glad to have the opportunity to draw because it looks like a...
Songs and artists at...
Univocity finds itself contextualized in polysemy at last. So that polysemy, which is the foundation of a compassionate life and a compassionate social order, provides the ends for which univocity, which is good at doing things, provides the means. And the distance closes into a viola made by Mr. Iizuka, right? That's his design. Private joke. There's a violin maker in Narbeth, Pennsylvania, who makes violas that are, well, they're not as ugly as, they're shaped rather much like this. So that's a possibility. It's not likely to happen. But it's, there are, can't talk about regulative sort of pictures. You keep certain things in your mind. Gandhi said an interesting thing one time, more than one thing. He said, you have to have a complete, fully fleshed out picture of an India of hundreds of thousands of completely autonomous villages doing for themselves, made up with no hypotactic organization whatsoever, villages of paratactic, i.e. happy and fulfilled people, with no villages, with no relationships to each other. Imagine that. He said you had to have this picture, even though he didn't expect it to come about very soon, because it would help you make the decisions of your daily life. Would this decision that I'm going to make promote the coming into being of this India, he would say? If the answer was yes, do it. If not, perhaps not. And this might be a kind of regulative picture for some people. But if I were a legislator, given the structure of this now 4-point terminus, what I would do would be very simple, really. I would exercise legislative controls on hyper-univocity and phony polysemy tomorrow. Hyper-univocity and phony polysemy are very serious enterprises, and they are susceptible to legislative judgment. And I'd work on it. And then I would redo the school system from preschool, there wouldn't be any, through graduate schools, I don't know if I'd keep them or not, such that every day in the life of human beings going to school, they would express all their competencies. Thank you very much.